It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In November, Rolling Stone magazine published a story about an alleged gang rape at the University of Virginia. It relied on the account of the victim. The magazine later apologized to readers, revealing it believed her story contained inaccuracies. Joining us to discuss these developments is Pittsburgh Post-Gazette columnist Tony Norman with us by phone. Tony, welcome.
Hey, Paul. Good to be here.
Also joining the conversation with us in Studio A, Jeff Ritter, chairman of the Department of Communications at Media, Communications and Technology at La Roche College.
Hi there.
Want to make sure I got your title right.
Thanks, Jeff. A lot.
Tony, you wrote a column about this Rolling Stone story, which has been discussed a great deal in the media of late, and there are more developments within the last 24 hours based on what the Washington Post has uncovered, finding a lot of holes in the story and how it was put together. But, Tony, you wrote a column about this that appeared earlier in the week in which you said Rolling Stone did the journalistic equivalent of a rat abandoning a sinking ship minus the rat's dignity. Sum up what happened here and why you are taking Rolling Stone to task.
Right. Basically, what Rolling Stone did is that it gave anonymity to a woman who probably was a victim of some sort of sexual assault, but not necessarily the one that she described in this 9,000-word article. This woman who was given the pseudonym Jackie allegedly was the victim of a gang rape at a fraternity house at the University of Virginia, in which she says she was gang raped by seven people, I believe. And instead of reaching out and interviewing people, especially the accused people for this story, the reporter, Sabrina Rubin Erderly, I think that's how you pronounce her last name, just used a single source, which was Jackie. She was dissuaded or discouraged from reaching out to the perpetrators, the alleged perpetrators. And so you ended up with this gigantic story with a single source who may or may not have been telling the truth, but as we're increasingly learning, probably not telling the truth. And so you have this incredible debacle of enormous proportions in terms of journalism and, unfortunately, setting back a little bit the cause of women coming forward to report on something that really truly is a prevalent problem in society, rape and sexual assault on campus and in the military and various other institutions.
And just to be clear here, it was the woman going by the pseudonym Jackie who convinced Rolling Stone's staff not to contact the alleged perpetrators of this sexual assault.
Exactly. But it's very few reporters, at least in my experience, who allow their subjects to dictate the who they can and cannot interview for, especially a major expose. I mean, that's just unprecedented. I've never heard of anything like that. You know, I've heard a subject saying, hey, I'm feeling reluctant about something. Let me look at my quotes in your story, but they can't really tell you as a reporter who to go and interview. That's really your prerogative and your institution's prerogative. So that was unusual.
And let's bring Jeff Ritter into the conversation. And is part of what's happening here based on competition? And, I believe Rolling Stone is one of those, it's an iconic magazine, but I believe it sells as the sales of other magazines in print have gone down dramatically. So is part of this about, getting the excitement of getting what can potentially be a blockbuster story and being able to run with it to sell magazines?
Yeah, I think definitely, they either wanted to rush it to print didn't feel they had the time to vet the story appropriately, or they felt this is going to be sensational. We're going to get tons of hits. We're going to sell magazines and keep up their reputation, which they justifiably have over the years of having great reportage of important stories, long-form journalism. They're one of the pioneers of that going way back into the 60s. And I think it is that they wanted to get something, get it out there. And they gave the reporter, the freelance journalist, Sabrina Erdely, I think too much leeway and didn't give her the get a chance to really look at the article like they should have. And now they're going to, now everybody's going to be looking at the rest of her articles and other Rolling Stone articles and say, what else is here? It's the Washington Post that really did it. Yeah, go ahead.
There seemed to be just an absence of even cursory editing. I mean, every day, you know, when you look at the reporting in the Washington Post on this story, you know, as they deconstruct it, I mean, there are major holes at every single level of reportage when it comes to this story. And it seems, I can't imagine what, if there was any editing done, any fact-checking, where it was done, because it seems to me that at every level, it just doesn't hold up.
Another amazing connection is, Tony, that Washington Post, owned by Jeff Bezos, who just invested in lots more reporters. He's putting a lot of money into the Washington Post, investigative journalism, and they've hit it. They hit a coup on a big story.
Yeah, well, what does the fact that the Washington Post swooped in and found the holes in the Rolling Stone story and the interview say about the relevancy of the old guard newspapers, which many people have declared dead?
Well, he's pushing it. He's making it happen and investing the money, and it may be paying off.
But I mean, is there still the need for these newspaper entities that see themselves as the gatekeepers when it comes to journalism and fact checking?
Yeah, sure. I mean, at the risk of seeming. I mean, obviously, I work for a newspaper, but I think it's very obvious that this story happened in the Washington Post backyard. I mean, it happened at the University of Virginia, which is in the circulation orbit of the Washington Post. And, this would have been a coup at their expense if it had been a true story that, you know, this major, major thing had happened. And so they looked at it. They wanted to see, well, how did we miss this? And they looked at the story and they reported it. They did everything you're supposed to do, all the due diligence you're supposed to do as a journalist. And they found that this story just did not hold up. I mean, because I really doubt very seriously that Rolling Stone would have reported on itself if it had later on found that there were discrepancies in the story. You really do need a fact checker like a major journalistic institution like the Washington Post to protect our interests when it comes to a story like this.
And I think that there's a lot of to what you're saying here, Tony. But at the same time, I'm blanking out on the reporter's name, but I think it was about in the early 80s. There's the famous story that won a Pulitzer Prize for a woman who wrote about
Janet Cook.
Janet Cook wrote about the, I believe it was an 8-year-old boy who was hooked on drugs, and then suddenly the police wanted to find him, and she couldn't.
Exactly.
And then all of a sudden the hole started appearing in her story, and it turned out she made the whole thing up, which
exactly.
May be worse than what Rolling Stone has evidently done. So this can happen. In the case of Rolling Stone, is it a case of, you know, the reporter maybe identifying with her subject and wanting to be sensitive and go along with her wishes in a case like this? Or is it simply, boy, I've got a great story here and I'm just going to run with it and maybe play fast and loose with the facts?
I think that's possible, but I think the thing that is most likely going to take place, and I've already taken a look at Sabrina Erdely's website. You can see the links to a lot of her other articles from Rolling Stone, Glamour, Self magazine, a bunch of other places. Start looking at them and see, what is she like? What other kinds of things has she been covering? But yes, she says she had trust in her in Jackie in this, and that she prides herself at a speech at Penn on her BS detector, and that may be great for her and for her being a reporter, but not for Rolling Stone in getting it out the door. They need more than her to
right,
do that.
Right. You know, and I think that you know, every reporter, if he or she are honest with themselves, you know, we all have opinions. But we're not necessarily agenda driven. You know, we have a responsibility to, if we're going to do journalism, to get all sides of a story, to be as objective as possible. Having said that, we can all agree that, you know, with a larger agenda, that, you know, the crisis of sexual assault is something that has to be dealt with in the media. It has to be dealt with responsibly. And she herself, as Ms. Erdely has herself said, that she went shopping for just the right story to sort of fit this narrative. And it's so ironic. She could have gone to any campus anywhere and gotten true stories, easily verifiable stories, and gone with it. But she went with the most horrific story she could find, and it turned out to be questionable at the very least. I hesitate to say it's untrue. I mean, I just don't know. They're still investigating the story already, but already it looks like it's just not going to hold up on any level.
Let's assume that everything that Jackie said in the story was true. So are we talking about taking a reporter to task for relying on one source? What if the one source is telling a story that eventually, you know, there are no holes in it? It's a true story, and eventually they find the guys who allegedly did it, and it all turns out to be accurate. So is it about the procedure, or are you saying that regardless of what comes up in the story, that there are certain procedures you must follow, and that includes talking to the alleged perpetrators of the crime and not just the victim?
Well, at least getting the facts straight and getting some verification from a second source on some of those. And they didn't have anything in there that verified anything. But I think one of the things that's amazing about it also is that she got the action right after the story. I mean, almost immediately, UVA shut down activities by fraternities on campus. And now, almost immediately after the post, they've reinstated them, right? They've turned completely around on their opinion, what they did from the article, which might have been a great coup for her and a great experience to feel like journalism makes a difference. And now it really made a difference in making it turn around again. And it's got to be very painful for her as well.
Yeah, I think that you need a second source or third source and a fourth source when you have such explosive allegations, when it could have implications that could really affect the reputation of a school and the, you know, alumni and the whole thing. I mean, you can't go to print or post online stories that haven't been vetted or facts that haven't been vetted or verified. It just seems, no matter how much potential good could come out of it, you could do just as much potential bad if the story doesn't check out. And so, yeah, I think that's that's non-negotiable. You have to have a second source, or else you're just going by hearsay.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about the Rolling Stone story published in November about an alleged gang rape at the University of Virginia, which relied on the account of the victim, the magazine later apologizing to readers, revealing it believed the story contained inaccuracies. We're with Pittsburgh Post-Gazette columnist Tony Norman, who is joining us by phone, and also Jeff Ritter of La Roche College, who is with us here in Studio A. And there have been in the last 24 hours more developments on this story. The Washington Post has reportedly identified new inconsistencies in this story told by the aforementioned Jackie, a University of Virginia student, in the pages of Rolling Stone. It also quoted one student who said Rolling Stone's claim that he declined to be interviewed by the magazine was wrong.
Right.
This student told the Washington Post that he never was contacted by Rolling Stone and would have agreed to an interview. What about this?
If that's true, I think heads really should start to roll at Rolling Stone, because there you're starting to get into some really serious territory. Because I do believe that the Washington Post, didn't they also say that the reporter did approach this gentleman?
Yes. Yes, I quoted the student, the magazine, according to what the Washington Post is reporting, the Post quoted one student who said Rolling Stone's claim that he, quote, declined to be interviewed, end quote, by the magazine was wrong.
Right, right.
And and by the way, the Rolling Stone is declining to comment on these new assertions.
Right, that was my next point. It just smells fishy, and I think that basically this 9,000-word story basically came in, sailed through with very little editing, and it went out there, and whoever is responsible for that particular misstep in the process really should get canned. I'm not even so much mad at the freelance reporter, because she probably expected some pushback on the story that might have helped it, you know, but she got none. She had no partner at Rolling Stone. It just went through, it seems to me, and it's out there now and just doing damage.
Well, and as someone who works for a newspaper who reports in print, Tony, what is the process? Is there a basic checklist that most newspapers and magazines go through? And I'm assuming there is. So how does it work?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first thing you do is, you get everyone on record. You know, you get the main source. Like, if you very rarely use a pseudonym. You very rarely use a pseudonym or disguise the person, because it just invites all sorts of journalistic malpractice down the road. The editor, everyone involved has to know who all the sources are and that they're trustworthy and that, you know, their facts have to be vetted. They have to be checked out. You can't take anyone's word for anything. You know, it's like, you know, trust but verify. You know, you have to make sure that everyone is on a level. And you just go down the line with everything, especially if it's a big, explosive story like this one. I can't imagine it just sort of coming in and going out without major parts of the allegations being checked out.
Jeff Ritter, what kind of a dent does a story like this put in the trust that people place in reporting, particularly print reporting?
Well, it's a little of both now for us. We can look at articles like Rolling Stone and long-form news stories and be a little bit questioning of what the accuracies are, what the reporter's agenda was, what the vetting or fact-checking was on it. But at the same time, we could look at Washington Post and say, you know, go Washington Post, yay journalism. You're going out there and doing cutthroat competitive journalism, not just looking at stories, looking for stories, but looking at other outlet stories for the blockbuster. And I'm sure other newsrooms around the country right now are saying, should we be doing this? You know, maybe it sounds like a typical Jeff Bezos plan to destroy your opposition. He can't go out and underprice them, but he can go out there and undercut their credibility, and I think other newspapers and outlets are going to start considering this as a full-time job for somebody.
We talked about the Janet Cook story from decades ago at the Washington Post, and now we have this situation with Rolling Stone, and then there have been other things that have occurred in between. Are we seeing, gentlemen, more media entities in this 21st century modern media age playing fast and loose with the facts, or not letting facts get in the way of a good story than we used to? Or is this just, you know, some newfangled yellow journalism that we used to see in the days of Hearst and others?
Well, I think it's going to be more and more of these things, and it already has been through the internet, through BuzzFeed, through Twitter, through all kinds of outlets. People want to get something out, get it out fast. Get the views, get the pages, and get the attention, and worry about the corrections later.
I agree. I think that's more the case. I think you would have seen more examples of this in the past if there had been an internet. I mean, before it was, you really had to wait like if you were a plagiarist or you were a fabulist or something like that, it really took some time for people to notice because, you know, we have a big country. And if you were vacationing in New Mexico and you saw an article you really liked and you thought, hey, I'm a columnist. When I go back to New York, I'm going to, like, copy whole sections of this. Chances are, you know, people wouldn't put two and two together because, you know, there was no internet. There was no way to compare things. And now, instantly, you can see whenever there's some journalistic malfeasance somewhere, anywhere, and people are more than happy to point it out, especially bloggers, people who just kind of look around for missteps by their favorite or, I guess, least favorite newspaper. So,
Tony, the one last point I wanted to touch on before we wrap this up that you made in your column earlier this week, you say that it's troubling that the media insist on treating victims of sexual assault as if they belong to a rarefied crime that prevents their names from even being used. Explain what you mean here.
Yes, I think that because it's such a terrible crime, and it is a crime, it also seems, because it's sex-related, we tend to treat the victims with more kid gloves, and it creates this whole aura of, well, we just can't talk about it too much. You know, we can't, like, really even report this if it happens because, you know, it would shame the victim so much. And I think that that's why there has been such an underreporting, a reluctance to go to the cops or a reluctance to report this because people feel on top of the pain and humiliation of being assaulted, they feel that maybe their morality will be questioned. And it's, you know, I'm saying that they are victims of a crime as much as if they were, you know, like shot at or robbed or, you know, any number of other things. And I think that we have to stop thinking of sexual assault as somehow apart from the whole, you know, continuum of crimes that happen to people every day. Yes, there is an intimate nature to this crime. But I think that we have to get past that and start treating sexual assault for what it is, primarily a crime against society and not just a crime against an individual. Because like a lot of rapists and sexual assaulters are serial assaulters. They do it over and over and over again, and they get away with it because people don't report them in the first place. And we have to get past this inappropriate sense of shame about being a crime victim.
Pittsburgh Post-Gazette columnist Tony Norman, and also joining us, Jeff Ritter here in studio. He is the chairman of the Department of Communications, Technology, and Media at La Roche College. Gentlemen, they've been talking about the Rolling Stone story, of which there are new developments that have been reported in the last 24 hours by the Washington Post. And gentlemen, thank you for helping us get caught up on the complicated issues surrounding this story of an alleged gang rape at the University of Virginia.
Thank you, Paul.
Good talk to both of you.
Coming up, we are going to take an immediate about face from the serious nature of the discussions we've been having so far in this show and look for a way to de-stress from the holidays. Travel contributor Elaine LaBaume suggests some bed and breakfast getaways in the Commonwealth. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.